Hello, welcome to another special edition of Shoot the Fence, because you know, we only do special editions these days. There's no such thing as a normal show anymore. I'm your host, Del, and I've got a very special guest with me. He is the author of the brand new book, How to Run a Football Club. Is that right?
Yeah, there's two books.
There's two. Modern Football is Shit. There you go. Yeah. See? Yeah. So yeah, welcome to the show, Jim Kyogan. How you doing, Geezer?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolute pleasure, man. And yeah, two books. Wow. That's a lot of hard work.
Well, the first one, How to Run a Football Club, was I think more hard work than the second one. The second one was more, but the second one was more fun to write, really.
Because the How to Run a Football Club, you go from grassroots, don't you? You studied it. You talk about the coaching. You talk about all the different elements involved in that part of the game, which a lot of people who are more focused on the top leagues aren't privy to that.
Yeah, I mean, really, I was the same. I mean, for years I've been like mainly an Evertonian and focused on the Premier League. And it wasn't until, I mean, I played Sunday League a long time ago, but for years, I was kind of focused on the top. And then my son kind of nagged me to get involved in coaching. And eventually I gave in. And it was the first time I'd gone back to that level, really, for a long time. And I was struck just kind of how poor it is. Not in terms of football or the quality of coaching, but just in terms of the facilities that you encounter week in, week out. And really, you've got this weird position where you've got an incredibly rich sport, like English football is, and at the very top, you're creating billions of pounds. And yet, at the very bottom, there's no money at all. And so kind of the idea of the book was to travel up the pyramid from juniors football right up to the Premier League and to look at, what it takes to run a club at these various levels. And also try and find out where the money is. Does it ever trickle down? Are there parts of the sport that are doing okay? And that was the journey that the book goes on, really.
So when you talk about the money being filtered down, because this is quite topical, because we've had the ESL, or the what was meant to happen, but then obviously they're not going through with it. And people are saying that if these clubs do decide to go into the Super League, then it's going to kill other clubs. But my argument is, look, I couldn't give a shit about those clubs that want to break away. Because if they want to break away, let them go. Fuck it. Because it makes things more interesting in the Premier League, in other leagues. You don't have these teams competing, and fair enough, people will say, well, the money coming in from the TV won't be as much as what it was before, but my argument is, well, it makes it fairer. It makes it fairer.
You're right. It would be a fairer system. And also, you could argue that for the last, 20, 30 years, we've had loads of money in the sport, and it doesn't go down to these levels anyway. I mean, part of it does. Certainly the Premier League does kick in really tiny amounts that does make a difference. But actually, whilst the kind of the industry as a whole has generated billions and billions of pounds, that hasn't made its way into the majority of the game. So, if these clubs did just bugger off, would it make much difference to grassroots football? Probably not, really. And you're right, it would create a fairer game in their absence, but it's certainly the money that has been created in football is primarily concentrated in a very small elite, and most of football is hard up.
Absolutely. And the one thing, and again, sorry for talking about this constantly, but with this ESL, I think Brexit might have had a bigger factor as well. The political side of things, especially when it comes to employment and all that. If you've got a club like Manchester United or Manchester City playing their games in Beijing or in the United States, perhaps it'll be easier for players to get work permits because they're not playing within the UK.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the kind of the big clubs already, I guess they're big brands now. I think their desire is to become relatively rootless. I'm not sure they want to be tethered necessarily to a country or even a community, really. You can envisage in the future these kind of massive international brands playing where they want and being based where they want. I mean, their ownership is already based in kind of, you know, offshore trust. They're no longer tethered to their communities in the same way that they once were. Yeah, they're all, obviously their main concern, as always, is the bottom line. They'll definitely be looking at things like, you know, rules on recruitment and how they can make money and how they can get around things, because they're not really like, they're not really football clubs as we know football clubs. They're businesses first and foremost, and, you know, they exist to make money, however that, you know, in whatever way they can. And the feelings of fans, or was it legacy fans, as they...
Legacy, yeah.
They called us, they don't matter, because they're thinking future fans, they're thinking emerging markets, kids. They don't care about people in their, you know, 30 years plus, they've been following clubs all their lives. You don't matter to them in the slightest.
Well, this is it. And this leads me on, or segues me on to my next question, which is regarding your book, your new book, Modern Football is Shit. Is these things that you've just mentioned, are these the reasons as to why you decided to write a book with that title and also all the content to do with it?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I'm old enough to have experienced, you know, what the pre-1992 football world, and so I've, you know, I've seen that die, and this kind of new version of football that we call modern football take its place. And there's no doubt there's plenty of good things in the modern game. It's certainly technically better, and you haven't got hooliganism, and you've got people trying to tackle things like racism and homophobia, and, you know, the game has certainly moved on, and you know, it's not all bad. But equally, alongside that, it's still a very frustrating game. It's, you know, it's not just the kind of stupid things that annoy you, like, you know, crap celebrations and shit kits. I mean, they are irritating, but there's fundamentally something wrong with the sport. There's something, you know, the ESL was probably the best expression of that. But you've also had recently Project Big Picture. And you've got this sense of a sport, as I said before, that is focused on, it's not focused on even kind of sport and merit or fan experience. It's about generating income as much as you possibly can. It's about milking fans, squeezing every drop of money out of them. And fans don't matter to these people because, you know, they can earn massive TV revenues elsewhere. They can fill their stadiums twice over with corporate tickets and tourist fans. It's that kind of sense of frustration that motivates me, that it's a sport that it's not a sport. Certainly at the top, obviously, if you go down the divisions, football hasn't changed that much. If you go down this non-league world and to grassroots football, it still feels like the sport I knew growing up. But certainly in the Premier League, maybe even Championship at times, it's a different kind of football that I don't necessarily recognise anymore.
So when did you decide to write this book? Because, you know, there must have been, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back to want to do something like this. You know, you got to get your inspiration from somewhere. Is this something that you've been planning to write about for a long time? Because for me, I know the inception of the Premier League in 92, 93 effectively started that trend, you know, of football becoming what it is now. But in my opinion, I think Euro 96 played a big factor, you know, with the tournament being in England. And you got a lot of these fans that perhaps used to watch rugby and cricket before that, oh, we're going to watch football now because it's fashionable. I don't know. What do you think?
I think you're right. That's an interesting tournament to mention, because I can recall being I was at university in mid-90s. I remember going up there, I think it may have been like 94 when I started. And I remember England being on the telly one night. I was sitting in the common room alone watching football because nobody liked the sport. And then 3 years later, coincided with Euro 96, and England were playing again, and the place was packed with all these people who 3 years earlier couldn't have given a shit about the game. So obviously, you're getting this kind of gentrification of football, you get the middle class drawn into it, and it definitely, they brought a different energy and kind of mentality to the game. But I think if you think about one kind of recent moment that kind of inspired me, it was experiencing football during the first lockdown.
Right.
I've always believed that fans matter and the fans are important. in football because I'm a fan and that's how football's always been. But that was the first when I was watching Everton play in empty stadiums and the game still went ahead and it was still functioning without any of us there. It was quite chilling because you think that not only is this, could football function without us, fine. It's also like we didn't seem to matter to the kind of the outcome or the experience. This was football just as a television event. And I thought this is like, I know it's a weird time, and it's a one-off and fans will come back, but it illustrated that how little we've come to matter to the sport at the very top. And that was the moment I thought, all the things that have bothered me for years, I thought there's something in this. That was the tipping point for me, I guess.
Well, it's interesting, again, you mentioned that because there's at Old Trafford, it's behind the goal. It's this big plastic sheet that's covering the seats, and it's got Matt Busby's famous quote of football without fans is nothing. The thing is, if you look at it in a more realistic sense, football without fans in the stadium doesn't make a difference. Because for me, from what I've seen, this is my opinion. Okay, fans not being in the stadium makes it more of a less pressure situation for footballers so they can express themselves more. They don't have people getting on their back. And that's probably because why we're getting so many high scoring games, not just because the quality of defending is shit in the Premier League. But when you look at the fans who are seen as customers, you don't need to worry about going to the mega store or the club shop to buy things because you could do it all online. When it comes to watching games, all it takes is a foreign TV channel or pay-per-view. So the clubs will make their money that way. So the fan experience isn't as important as what it used to be. And I think COVID or the pandemic has shown to a lot of clubs, especially the big clubs, that fans aren't really that important when it comes to the actual match day. But apart from that, buying shirts, scarves, half and half scarves, and other things as well. That's what matters, isn't it? The green, the dollar.
Yeah, exactly that. I think you're right. I think the kind of COVID has given the people behind the big clubs an insight. Maybe something they suspected for a long time. I think they realised that they can function a different way. As long as I guess what they want long term is to have control over their broadcasting, and if they can do that and not have to share revenue with other clubs and go into these markets like China, like India, like the Middle East, where there are massive amounts of fans of big clubs, then they could probably have a model that could function independent of what happens on match day. I think that's what they want. That match day income is great for them, and people coming and buying shares and all that kind of stuff, and they can have that. But I think their eye is on TV revenue, yeah, and how to maximise that and how to corner the market and how to make sure that other clubs don't get a look in. And then if you get 60,000 to the gate, that's great because it's more money, but ultimately it doesn't matter because you're selling to China, you're selling to India, and that's where you're making your proper money, I think, in the end.
Absolutely, mate. All right, so let's delve into this book then. What can you tell us, not to give too much away, but what should we expect from this book?
It's an A to Z. It goes through, it's like five entries roughly per letter, and it's just picking up stuff that irritates me about modern football. I hope irritates other people. So it's the usual suspect. It's like, half scarves, goal music, transfer deadline day, whatever. Corporate seats, tourist fans, what else is there? Horrible kits, glory hunters, all the things that, just wind you up about the game. And I seem to become either symptoms of modern football or more prevalent during the modern game as well.
Is FIFA 21 on that list?
It is.
Gamers, yeah?
It is because... See, I play FIFA, but I think FIFA is the future of the sport. I think the people who run football look at FIFA and think that's what we want. We want massive score lines. We want superstar players. We want you want big brand teams and you want like ridiculous football where the scoreline could be, you know, 8-5 or 12-10. That's the future that they're trying to gear towards football towards, to have like, they don't want a horrible 0-0 between Burnley and West Brom. They want a game like, you know, someone like Dortmund against Chelsea when the scoreline's like 8-5. So I think you play FIFA and you think it's ridiculous, but actually the seeds of future football are there, I think.
Yeah. And I think because of FIFA, you're seeing a lot of players being supported more than clubs. Like Anthony Martial is a perfect example. Martial FC, they call them, these fans. You know, he could play for any team in the world, but they're going to support him. They're not going to support the club that he plays for.
Are you spot on? That's a recent development. And I've seen that amongst like kids my son's age, where they love Neymar and they love Messi and players like that. And so that they will support Barcelona when Neymar is there, and then they'll switch allegiance to PSG when Neymar goes there. That's something alien to me. I don't understand that at all. But actually, amongst kind of the FIFA generation, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And I think the thing for me that's alien, I'm 40 years old now, but I went to the gym today. Not that that's alien. I went to the gym today and I saw three people wearing Paris Saint-Germain shirts. It weren't like the full kit. It was like a T-shirt, like a training shirt, or one will have the Nike logo with a PSG badge. I'm thinking, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, would you be wearing that? What is it about this club that all of a sudden people are wearing their gear? And I thought, well, they did a collaboration with Michael Jordan, and it's almost as if the marketing machine is working. It hypnotized people.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, I think there was some research done by, I think it was Copper 90, into kind of the nature of fandom amongst younger fans. And he was saying that like this idea of diluting your fanship is becoming more common. So whereas like maybe when we grew up, you picked a team and then that was it. You followed that team, no matter how badly they did, you just stuck it up and that was your side. Whereas now you've got people who will support maybe Liverpool and Dortmund and maybe a French team, and they'll dilute it around, and they'll try and generally it's clubs who are going to give them success. So you can support, you know, PSG in France, you'll support Barcelona in Spain, you'll support Man U in England. And it's about if you're going to emotionally invest in football, it's about getting bang for your buck. It's kind of making sure that you feel happy and you see cups, rather than the old model of fanship, which was, I guess, you know, if you don't win a trophy for 25 years, like Everton haven't, then too bad. That's just your lot in life. So it's definitely, that's probably more a case in amongst younger fans, but it's definitely something that sense of dilution of not being kind of tethered to one team for life is definitely something that's happening.
Yeah. The thing is, coming from a Mediterranean background and, you know, family in Cyprus, I've seen it kind of like the other way around, whereby my relatives or friends from the island support a team in Cyprus, but they also support a team in England. So I've got a friend, Sogradi, supports Omonia, which is my team, but he also supports Everton.
Yeah,
I've got another guy that supports Omonia and supports Man United. So it's different in nations like that, because while they do have that love for their local team, they're always going to follow a bigger team around the world, because that's just how it is. It's more the opportunities to win the big prizes and to call yourself a fan of that club is greater. Or, for, you know, they might like a player that used to play for that team and has gone on to do great things. So it's different. You know, you see it in the Czech Republic. I know people from there and they support, you know, Sparta Prague or Slavia Prague or whatever. And then they support AC Milan. You're thinking, the fuck did that come from? But then they're saying, you know, I watched Milan when they were dominant in the 90s and I like the trio, the Dutch trio. And then that's how it builds, really.
I think it was like you've always had it in this country to a degree where you've got your first love at me, but maybe like you might watch a local non-league team. That level of that kind of not necessarily dilution, but there's always been an element of it. But I think what's different now with a lot of younger fans is that it's not a case of I'm supporting a small local team and a big club. It's I'm supporting a big club and a big club and another big club and another big club, and it's you're holding like four allegiances to maybe the four biggest clubs in European football, just so that each season you can feel success. I think that's the kind of, that's the change now. It's about not I guess not having a horrible season. You can't, they can't tolerate the idea that this season you'll win nothing, which is the nature of football, but they don't want that.
Yeah, there you go. Well, look, tell me about the most difficult part of the book that you wanted to write. And by difficult, I mean, you're thinking, why the fuck am I going to write about this? Because it angers me so much.
That's a good question. Because there's so much in there. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Well, I mean, there's elements in there of... I guess the one that is... I guess the most disgusting entry in there would be Qatar 2022.
Right.
Like a lot of things that I write about, it's slightly tongue-in-cheek, and the idea is to kind of, you know, try and be funny. It was very difficult to find anything funny about that, because actually when you go through it from you know, it hasn't even started yet, but like the bidding process was, you know, riddled with corruption. And then when you go through what kind of state Qatar is, you look at kind of the there was something like someone said if you had a minute's silence for every migrant worker who would have died before the tournament starts, then the entire competition will be played in silence. So that's kind of the level of kind of...
Wow.
Yeah, which is horrific. I mean, just for a football tournament, really just a reputation wash, a terrible state. I think, you know, you look at the state, how that state treats, you know, gay people, how it treats its migrant workers, how it treats women. And then you've got its effect on football. We're changing the entire football calendar just to accommodate this kind of strange tournament. I think from start to finish, everything about it has been disgusting, really. It's the worst way to use football. So it was a difficult one to write, because, you know, there's nothing funny about it. It's just FIFA at its worst and world football at its worst. And I guess the worst thing about it is that it hasn't even happened yet. I mean, it'll probably be a success and everyone will like it, but behind the scenes, it's disgusting. It's a disgusting kind of stain on football. And yet it's gonna go ahead.
Yeah. And the thing is, when you look at the previous World Cups, I mean, if you look at, say, for example, USA 94, right? I think USA 94 had the same idea as Euro 96 to kind of boost the nation's interest in football. So I can, but then again, I don't think the USA ever had a World Cup. So that I kind of accepted. France 98, fine. But then 2002, you had South Korea and Japan, another part of the world where football was kind of in its infancy, really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Then obviously came South Africa a few years or more years down the line. And you're thinking, South Africa is a bit of a strange decision, you know? And then more and more, Russia. And now you've got Qatar. And when's the one after Qatar?
I don't know. Oh, is it the USA and Canada?
USA and Canada.
Yeah.
Canada, they've just brought in the Canadian Premier League last year, I think. So again, another way to try and put asses in seats, so to speak. But that's what it's all about now. It's like a roadshow, isn't it?
It really is. And it's, you know, you imagine it's behind the scenes, these countries that are bidding from it. There has to be backhanders. These tournaments at some point should be in countries that have existing football infrastructure, just because that would be fair. But it's always going to places where, but generally, I know they're different from Russia, but it's always going to places where you're thinking, like, well, I think Qatar's the best example. You think, why is it there? Why is it going to a country that has no football history at all? Can't even host a summer event. It's just weird. So, I don't understand it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you've got half and half scarves as one of yours.
Yeah.
And for me, I used to buy them purely because, yeah. And the only reason why I bought them is because I knew that later on in life, people would want them. So yeah. That's it. I mean, I remember it was the Champions League final, it was Dortmund against Bayern at Wembley. And I went to Stratford because they had the fan park there, and Figo and all these other players were there, Pires, whatever. And I bought a half and half scarf, an official one, because I knew maybe in 2022 or 20, whenever, someone's going to want that. It's going to be on eBay or something. And the people that sell them outside, the official, the unofficial ones, you know, the t-shirts. I bought those ones as well, the half and halves, because I knew, again, one day someone's going to get all nostalgic and think, shit, I wish I bought a half and half scarf. There you go. That's the only reason I got them. Only reason.
But that was smart, because there is massive demand for it. People do, you know, I mean, these stores wouldn't exist if people didn't want these products. I don't get it. I don't understand why you...
No, neither do I. Why would you want to get a Man United, Man City half and half scarf? It wouldn't make sense, but there are people out there that collect them.
Bizarre. It's, you know, it's just to go to a game and to wear, you know, even if you're going to support one team and you wear the colours of the team, I could never wear a Liverpool scarf. It would sicken me to have that, if just half of it on me. And yet, they're a symptom of a different kind of fan, I guess. Someone who's going there for the spectacle. They're treating football maybe like, I don't know, like going to the cinema or going to the theatre. They're going for the event and you're getting a souvenir of the event. Whereas I think for fans who really, you know, love their teams, you would never, ever buy a piece of merchandise that had the colour of the opposition on it. You'd never do it unless you and you're looking for kind of, you know, an investment for the future. But in general, you would never do it. I don't really get how they've emerged, apart from obviously to cater for that demand.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think these days you're seeing more and more fanzines dying. And for me, buying the fanzine before a game was always part of the tradition, you know, going to games. I never bought a match day program, even though, you know, I was paying my money to go watch that team and I didn't like the owners. I still don't like the owners, but I was still going. But the fanzine had to be done every month.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the match day program was often quite sterile, wasn't it? It was kind of just a bit of kind of propaganda.
Manager's notes. We've got a very difficult opponent today.
Exactly. And, you know, it was boring. I mean, you got the fanzine. It was, you know, it was funny and it was aggressive and it really captured the mood of the fans. It took the piss out of the club, which is what you want. It's what you want, really. But you're right. I mean, I can recall going the game and like you kind of, the extra money was for like chips and the fanzine, not for, you know, what it is now, which is, you know, going to the game and getting getting a half scarf. Or you go somewhere like West Ham, you can go and get pick and mix before the game on the concourse. Half scarf and pick and mix is not, you know, maybe that's an age thing, but to me, it's alien to me that.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think you might concur with this, or you might feel the same way. For me, football started dying, or should I say the match day experience started to die when we got all-seater stadiums. Now, obviously, it had to be done, but the terraces, they're so important, so, so important. And I go to stadiums in Europe, for example, again, I talk about Cyprus, a lot of stadiums don't have seats. It's just concrete steps.
Yeah.
You know? And when the fans were allowed in the stadium, they could take flares, they can take firecrackers, everything. You can't do that in the UK. So again, it's like you were saying before, it's all sterile.
Yeah, I think it makes it quite sedate. I mean, I can compare going to watch Everton in the Gladys Street when it was terrace, and it's not like it is now when it's all seated. It's still a good atmosphere, but it's not like it was. And if you go to kind of you go and watch clubs lower down the divisions, which I've done occasionally, and you stand, like I've been to watch Wimbledon, you go and stand on their terraces. It's just different. It's a better experience. I mean, it's not necessarily comfortable. And I can recall being younger at Everton and being, you know, when goals go in, I was going flying across places, and I was, you know, I wasn't a big shithouse, so I couldn't always hold my own. But it was exciting in a way that it just isn't when you're sitting down. It's just something just changes your mentality. You know, it's definitely, I think that's played a massive part in why the atmosphere at the game isn't what it once was. That, and maybe the fact that the average age of a Premier League fan is much older than it used to be, because they're the only people who can afford to go. So you've got kind of middle-aged, middle-class men sitting down watching football. They're not going to make the same noise as a bunch of 14-year-old scallies on the terraces who were, you know, going mental.
That's right. Do you know what? I get the feeling that there's going to be lots of parts of this book that I can agree with and relate to. I think you got one about celebrity refs as well. Is that aimed at one in particular?
Oh, it's just they do me.
I'm a Rovers fan.
Yeah, definitely. It's just I was talking to someone before saying that I can recall when I was younger, I didn't know the names of referees. They weren't they were there, and they'd irritate you, but they weren't like famous people. They were there to officiate, and they sort of just did their job, sometimes good, sometimes poorly. But now you get the feeling that the refs think they're a big deal. You know, they think they're kind of maybe as important as the footballers. You've got so much more talent than they have. And like they're prancing around and making kind of, you know, emphatic gestures and they seem to really relish their role. I think there was one last season when I think it's Cavana. Chris Cavana, is that a referee?
Yes, Chris Cavana, yeah.
He sent off Ancelotti at the end of the Everton game. He just made a poor decision. Everton should have won, and Ancelotti was rightly furious. And the look on the referee's face, it was so kind of haughty. I'm thinking you could just see he was just, he sent him off, and you could just see the sense of relish in his face because he just thought he was so fucking great. You're thinking, that's not what you're meant to be. You're meant to be unseen. A good referee should be invisible to the play, not, you know, some kind of prancing dickhead who thinks he's all that. Yeah. So they're definitely in there, yeah.
Yeah, for me, when I was growing up, the referee I hated most was David Ellery.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking hell. And he was a public school teacher as well. So I think that's why I disliked him even more.
he was a twat. He was probably kind of the start of this trend. Somebody who thought he was just all that.
Yeah.
And like, you forget, they're surrounded by people who are much more talented than them. You know, top-flight footballers are really skilled at what they do. Referees, they aren't all
that. What did you make of Uriah Rennie and Kalina? Because they didn't fuck about, did they?
No, they didn't. I mean, I think... I guess they had a different sort of energy about them. But, I mean, I still think they're kind of symptomatic of this new trend. I still think there's... I mean, could you name any referees from... Apart from Ellery, from that era, can you name any from back then?
Paul Durkin. The one... Oh, God. I forget the guy's name. It got pushed over by Di Canio. I forget his name. I could see him still falling backwards. But you know, I can't remember that many names. Paul Durkin, I remember because he was ginger. Who else? Mm-hmm. Fucking hell. It's a difficult one now.
Because they weren't a big deal.
Klattenberg, but then again, that's more this year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas
now you sort of, you know, if you don't necessarily know the name in your head, oh yeah, yeah, it's kind of they're like superstar referees. Mm-hmm. I think some of them have an eye on getting the big games in Europe. I think they're thinking if I kind of, you know, if I look fit and I'm shown to kind of, you know, do me stuff, I get noticed. I think
a lot of them aren't fit. That's the thing.
No, I know, you're right. Some of them look, shouldn't be on a fucking pitch in the first place, but I make a name for myself maybe and I kind of, you know, I catch the eye, then maybe I could be doing a World Cup or I could be doing Champions League rather than just doing the job. Here and being better at it as well.
Yeah, true. All right. Another question relating to the book. What was your favourite part of the book? What bit did you really relish writing about?
TalkSport. I don't particularly like TalkSport that much, and so I enjoyed writing about that. I really don't like Kelvin McKenzie, who was the kind of fan.
He's the guy that about Hillsborough, isn't it? The son.
He's one of the worst, you know, without killing somebody or that kind of stuff, he's one of the worst examples of a human that you can imagine. He's just, everything he touches is just disgusting and shit. And I think, you know, TalkSport's got good elements, and the more it moves away from McKenzie's model, the better it will be. But the moment it still feels like it's kind of a oral version of the Sun. It's got Sun elements about it.
But the thing is with TalkSport, if you research into the company and see who like the executive director is, that person used to be doing the same job at the BBC.
Really?
And yeah, and she has a close relationship with the CEO of a talent management company who has the likes of Jens Lehmann, Sam Matterface, Michael Carrick. And a lot of people that appear on TalkSport quite regularly.
Right.
So there's like gatekeepers that prevent people from moving around and allow certain people in. But I'm not going to get into that. And I'll tell you more about it off air or when I've stopped recording, because your mind will be blown.
I just think it's one of those things. It seems to just exist to kind of cause controversy. I think that a better play, if you really want to kind of array, listen about football, there's better radio stations. The BBC, like a local BBC station, do a better service than TalkSport does. Fan, when fan TV and fan kind of podcasts are done well, they're much better than TalkSport. I don't really know what it offers, to be honest. It's just a weird station that just has.
Well, I think that's why they're bringing on a lot of these influencers now. You see Craig Mitch that has done a few things for Spurs. You see Robbie from AFTV having that little argument with Ray Parlour, which obviously is a little bit staged, in my opinion. So they're bringing a lot of these social media guys onto it, which is fine. Don't get me wrong, because we're meant to be in a meritocracy, and if you're getting someone on merit, not because you know someone that knows someone, then fair enough. But at the same time, you're still seeing a lot of shit that happens on fan cams on the radio for attention and bites. And I don't get it, really.
That's, isn't it? It's attention. It talks about, I think they live for kind of social media and getting, likes and getting people to reach with it. It digs. It seems like they're there to generate content to try and kind of get people, rather than necessarily what you want from radio is to in kind of to inform you and to kind of educate you. You want to learn more about the game. I just think you can get that better elsewhere, much better.
TalkSport 2 are actually better than TalkSport, to be fair, when it comes to content. And that's being brutally honest. So yeah, speaking of fan channels, do you watch Toffees TV? Have you ever? Yeah, any good?
I mean, there are out there. There are plenty of poor, obviously, because it's you're gonna good and bad. But I think when kind of fan TV and kind of fan-led media is done well, it's really good. Because what I think what you get is you get the sense of what you used to get with fanzines. You just get it in kind of a visual form. You get the sense that I think it's done well when they're not kind of they have no connection to the club. That's when it's done well. When they're truly free to say what they want to say. There are some fan channels that sort of, I think they want to land interviews and they sort of act with players and managers and they pull the and because of that, they pull the punches. I think the Anfield Rap have done that. They've sort of slightly sold out for access. Whereas the Everton ones, they're good. They're really good. And Toffee TV is just just two fellas. And then they get fans on all the time. They get a few ex-pros on as well. And they educate you, and they kind of the debates around Everton are honest as well, and they will they'll mirror the views of the fans, and that's what you want, really.
Yeah, and the thing is, a lot of these fan channels that want to get access to players. For me, look, doing podcasts for close to 10 years now, I've learned that. I would rather speak to a former professional than someone that's still in the game playing for a club, because at least the former pro can tell you a lot of things. The current footballer has to watch what they say, or maybe you have to send them a list of questions which goes through their solicitor or goes through the club's media guy, and then they cross off things that you can and can't. And so again, it's like a watered down version of an interview. You're not going to get anything. So when I see people on the BBC and all that interviewing, and they're like, oh yeah, on social media, oh yeah, I interviewed my hero, yada yada yada. But what have you actually got off them? You haven't really got anything, because
There's no way the club is so protective of the brand. There's no way they're gonna let you. As you said, you won't get anything. Whereas you're spot on when you talk to former pros you will get something off them. You'll get honesty. And it's the fan channels that I think realize that access is not worth it, not worth kind of diluting what you do. They're the ones that I think people respect in the end.
That's right. Well, Jim, tell us where we can purchase this book, mate. Or the books, plural.
Yeah, if you go to the publisher's site, Pitch Publishing, they'll have links to different places. But aside from that, on Amazon at the moment as well.
Excellent. Wonderful. Well, look, before I let you go, is there anything else you would like to plug, my friend?
No, just those two books. That's fine.
Okay. Right. No Twitter handle, no nothing like that?
I'm on Twitter. I'm at Jim Keoghan on Twitter.
Excellent. Wonderful. Well, there you go, ladies and gents. Buy the books. And I'm sure you'll be very, very pleased. I was going to say get them for Christmas, but like Christmas is gone. Get them for the next holiday. There you go. For the next time you go on holiday, because COVID is dying down now and we can all go on holiday soon. So get it for the plane, get it for the beach, get it for when your missus is in the shower and she's taking too long. So until next time, ladies and gents, take care.